Well, up next on Downtown, he's one of our favorite people to talk to. You know him from countless roles on television, in films, Emmy nominee and author now, along with environmentalist and activist Ed Begley Jr. joining us to talk about his wonderful memoir, To the Temple of Tranquility, and Step on It. Ed, it's great to have you back with us. And I will tell you that the thing that stood out to me in reading this terrific book is your sense of gratitude.
Thank you, Rich, and I am likewise grateful to be on with you again. I always have a great conversation with you, and so I appreciate you taking the time with me, buddy.
Well, the book is delightful, and I guess right up front, should we probably thank your daughter, Hayden, for making this possible?
Exactly. What happened was, for better or for worse, it started with my daughter saying, let me just capture on my iPhone some of these stories that you tell about this one and that and the business and other things having nothing to do with the business, just incredible things that you've encountered in your life. And I'll get as much of it as I can of your, 70-some-odd years in show business on my iPhone, my battery and data plan allowing. So we started doing it, and pretty soon I went, wait a minute, maybe I'll start writing some of this stuff down, and maybe I'll meet a ghostwriter one day who'll want to do it. And I, after a few more pages, I went, I don't want to turn this over to anybody, including my daughter. I want to do it myself, and I did it, and I had a ball writing it.
Well, there are some remarkable stories, and you have encountered so many amazing people in your life and in your career, but you were pretty unsparing and pretty hard on yourself in discussing your battles with addiction.
Yeah, I had a real bad decade in the 70s and then in key ways. I had a lot of good fortune in the 70s, too. My first wife and I had two wonderful children. I'm extremely close to this day, but I had some downs with the ups, and the downs were very down. I not only drank a quart of vodka nearly every day from 71 through 78, but I also operated a vehicle, Rich, and I do not recommend that at all. The fact that I didn't kill anybody is one of my biggest forms of gratitude. If I had somehow killed myself, that would have been, write that guy off. He deserved it. But if I had harmed person or a family in another vehicle or pedestrians, I don't think I could live with that.
Well, we're going to be very respectful of the SAG-AFTRA strike situation, so we're not going to talk about any specific projects, but so many people along the way who are part of your story, and I will say, starting out, I would love to have been a fly on the wall with you and Harry Dean Stanton at Dantana's back in the day.
We had some fun, I'll tell you. We went to a restaurant in L.A. called Dantana's, and it's right just two doors down from a wonderful club called the Troubadour. It was around since the 60s in L.A., and a wonderful club that had great acts there. The Eagles, Bette Midler, Elton John, Jackson Brown, comedians went up there. All the top comedians were often opening acts, and I was an opening act for there. Don McLean, Canned Heat, John Sebastian, lots of other people I opened for at the Troubadour and at other venues at Nassau Coliseum. So I toured as a stand-up comic for a while. Harry Dean was key to me, getting to know people in L.A. and getting to have some wisdom as an actor and as a person because of his fondness for a guy named Alan Watts.
And I didn't know until I read the book that at least for a short time there, you were in a comedy team with Michael Richards.
I did have a comedy duo with Michael Richards. We went to L.A. Valley College together, Los Angeles Valley College in the San Fernando Valley, where we both lived. And we decided to go on sheer chutzpah. We got a slot at the open mic night. They called it the Hoot Night at the Troubadour. We went up there and did very well. So the owner, Doug Weston, wanted to manage us. And we pursued it a bit, but never quite got any headway because I didn't have the work discipline that Michael had or anyone should have to be a stand-up comic. So as a duo, he went off in the Army. He got drafted, went off and served in Germany. And so I went off on my own and finally sat down and wrote some material. And that's when I started to tour and open for people like Don McLean and Neil Sedaka and, at the Troubadour and the Bottom Line, Max's Kansas City, Nassau Coliseum. I went all over and really got some great training as a comedian by doing stand-up.
We've had the pleasure of talking with so many friends of Harry Nilsson, from Jimmy Webb to Mickey Dolenz, Brian Wilson, Alice Cooper, Harry's son Keith. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with Harry?
I met Harry Nilsson through mutual friends, and we hit it off right away because he was of Irish extraction, I think, too. He had some Irish heritage, and so I certainly had a thirst like he did, like many Irish people do. He could hoist a few, and so I made the mistake of trying to outdrink him more than once, and I paid a dear price for that. But he introduced me to John and Yoko. He introduced me to to the whole Monty Python gang. I got to meet Eric Idle and Graham Chapman and all of that lot, John Cleese through him. So I'm very grateful for Harry Nilsson's wonderful influence on my life in many ways. He was a great friend and a great musician, great songwriter, and Una, his wonderful widow, is still around and has a wonderful family, great, great kids. I'm very happy to know those great people.
And there's a wonderful story in the book about how that introduction to John and Yoko enabled you to at least place a call to be a part of a little plot, a little plan.
Yeah, we were having dinner with them, with John and Yoko, and it was Harry and Una, me and John and Yoko, and Sean in the other room and asleep. But they talked about watching, first of all, they were fans of Mary Hartman, which I couldn't get my mind around that they even knew who I was, but they did. And then they started talking about watching another show called Saturday Night Live, where $1,000 was a check was held up by Lorne Michaels saying, "We'd like to offer you guys, I hear you're talking of a reunion, you're fielding a lot of offers for a reunion, but if you come on Saturday Night Live, we will give you," and then he held up the check, $1,000, split up any way you like. And so they watched that together. John Lennon and Paul McCartney saw that and went, "Let's get in the cab and go down there and get our check." You know, they're going to play a joke like that on us. We'll top them by going down and actually picking up the check and playing a few boxes of music. And they got down there, and somehow, I don't know what happened, they turned around at some point. One or both of them decided that wasn't a good idea. So they were proposing to do it again. My friend Buck Henry was going to host the show. And so he said, "We're going to do it again and offer them $2,000, you know, if just one of them comes," or what have you. And they didn't take him up on it, but I got to be the go-between and call John and Yoko and tell them of this plan in case they wanted to go to, 30 Rock and pick up a check.
I love that story. We're talking with Ed Begley Jr. His book is entitled To the Temple of Tranquility, and step on it. Another regular on our show who's a great friend of yours, the wonderfully talented Peter Asher.
God, I love Peter. I see him all the time. He and his wife, Wendy, are dear friends of Rochelle and mine. And actually, Peter's right now in New York. My wife is there, too. They went to see Ed Ruscha, the artist Ed Ruscha's show, and saw a lot of Broadway shows. So we're very close to the Ashers, and what a talent he is. Great songs he's written. World Without Love is a great song. He certainly, I think he kind of finished a song. That was a song that Paul McCartney had started to write, and then Peter finished it up and had a great hit with it, of course. But great songs were written by Paul on his piano in his parents' house, and there's an incredible history with Peter Asher and the Beatles and everybody, and James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt and all these great talents that he managed over the years. He's a great record producer, he's a great manager, and a great, great friend.
Our producer, Kerry Haskell, this is his last week on the show before he moves to New Orleans. He and his wife bought a house there a few years ago, and one of his favorite spots, it comes up in the book. You mentioned when you were shooting a film with Paul Schrader, stopping in for lunch at Commander's Palace.
Great restaurant. I went there in the 80s. The food is fantastic, and the ambiance, of course, in that great city, everywhere, certainly in that restaurant, is incredible. I was back there recently doing a new show called Queer as Folk, and really enjoyed that. I just love getting to New Orleans. It's spectacular. My friend Harry Shearer and Judith Owen live there in that fine city, so everything about that town is great for me.
Since we spoke with you last summer, Ed, we've lost a friend of our show, but a great friend and a longtime friend of yours, Cindy Williams. What a remarkable woman. And another great story in your book of a relationship that didn't go the way you wanted early in life, but certainly turned out to be longer and probably much more beneficial than if you'd had a romance.
She was a great friend. I had a mad crush on Cindy Williams, but she had the good taste to have affections for a man that was an incredible producer and became a dear friend of mine. His name was Harry Giddes. But before that, I took her on a date before she went with Harry. I picked her up in my electric car, and I think the kid on the big wheel was passing us by. It was going so slow. You know, a butterfly went past us. So I didn't get a second date out of that, but we had a good laugh about it. We became great friends, and we're great friends till she passed about a year ago now. What a great lady. I met everybody in Hollywood I met, I probably met through her. And what a talent. Travels with My Aunt, The Conversation, American Graffiti. You know, people know her for Laverne and Shirley, and she was fantastic in that series with Penny Marshall. But what a great film actress she was, too. And an amazing friend. And godmother to my daughter, Amanda.
And every time she was on with us, she made a point of telling a story, usually involving your electric car, especially the time when you killed all the power at her house at a big party.
That's right. I plugged in. Come on, I just need a little bit of oomph to get back home. And I plugged in and everything died, the music and everything. So I can't believe she still continued to speak to me right up to the end. Amazing lady. I loved her a lot.
Boy, it sure sounds too, Ed, like all of us would be lucky if we had a friend in life like you did with Bruno Kirby.
He was an amazing man. My dad was a great father and a great person. He taught me some great lessons. But there was kind of a feeling of Darwinism in my house, you know, kind of every man for himself, too, which I needed a bit of. I'll be quite honest with you. I went to military school for a while, and I needed that. I needed some structure in my life. But as far as loyalty and really being there for your friends, Bruno was a teacher to me and so many other people. He lived it. He was a kind man. He was a great talent. Donnie Brasco, Godfather 2. You know, when Harry Met Sally, City Slickers, everything that he did on stage and on screen, big and small screen, he was always spectacular. And he really guided me as a person and as an actor to pursue my craft better, to be more serious about it, not just want to get a series and make some money, but to work on the craft and do good work. That all came from Bruno, so I will forever be in his debt, that great, great friend.
You write about a couple of harrowing incidents that both happened to take place on February 17th, which you refer to as your lucky day in the book, and it was Bruno that kind of helped you reframe the way you looked at those incidents.
He did. He always tried to find the positive. He reasoned that there was no point in dwelling on the negative. It was there, and you had accepted and deal with it, but focus, take the high road and focus on what's working in your life and, you know, make things positive. And so I did that. I was in the hospital with a fractured femur. I'd gotten going out foolishly between sets at the Ice House. I was going to try to run to a Hollywood party between sets, and the foolishness of that occurred to me finally, and I started to head back to the Ice House, and the guy ran a red light and put me in traction and a spica cast for 14 weeks. So it was a mess. And Bruno brought me food every day, went to the bank for me with my checks, and did everything a person could do. He lived in Hollywood, and I don't know if you know the geography well, Rich, but from Hollywood to Pasadena is no quick drive, you know. And he would do that every day and help me, nourish me back to health, took me around to different functions. And then O'Toole's birthday party, his girlfriend's birthday party, me in a full spica cast in the back seat, you know, laying horizontally and kind of at an angle to fit into the car, 6'4" with plaster on everything but my right leg. What a friend. We lost him in 2006, the same year I lost my wonderful first wife, Ingrid. So I'll never forget Bruno. He changed my life and for the better.
There's a wonderful story in the book about your friendship with Brandflex, Marlon Brando, who wanted you to get involved in a project. It wasn't quite what you expected, though.
No. I mean, he would call me up and, Edward, it's Brandflex. Give me a shout. I got a production I want to do. There's a project. I have all the financing in place. and we've got distribution. Get up here and let's get started, for God's sake. I ran up there. Wow, he's got the financing. He's got distribution. There's a project he wants to do with me. Finally, we can talk about acting. We never really talked about acting. We talked about, like, mechanical stuff and solar panels, and here we go. Wow. So I got up there, and he started to say, Ed, do you know how many volts an electric eel puts out? how many volts an electric eel? No, I don't know how many volts. A couple hundred volts, maybe, but a fraction of an amp, not a lot of current. See, this is why it's perfect for you. We're going to put electric eel. What's the name of the town down the coast? I started to rattle off names. Huntington Beach, Steel Beach. Or, no, go further. La Jolla, that's it. They're going to give me a bunch of electric eels, and we're going to put them in every. What are you going to do with the eels? You mean like a moat to keep people away from your house? He was very private. I thought he was going to have a moat with electric eels. No, we're going to power every home in America. You're going to power every home in America with electric eels? Rich, I thought he was winding me up. I thought he was having me on. But no, he was serious. He wanted to power his home with electric eels. And so I brought up the reasons why that would not work. And he was disappointed. He wanted to harness, literally, I think, harness the eels, put a little harness on them with some wires to capture the voltage, which wouldn't have been very practical. But he did have some great ideas. He and Dr. Craven, this friend of his who's a wonderful scientist, came up with something called deep ocean water cooling. In resorts, a kilowatt hour is very expensive, like in Tahiti where Marlin had property. Very expensive because it all comes in the form of diesel fuel. Then you burn the diesel fuel to generate power. So to get the diesel fuel there to Tahiti and then to burn it, it's like 50 cents a kilowatt hour. It's very expensive. So, but if you could do important chores with that energy, most of it is for heat, for cooling people, to keep the food cold and the workers cold and the guests cold, not cold, but cool. You can do that with deep ocean water for just a fraction of the energy. And he came up with that system with Dr. Craven, and it's amazing. It's working today in tropical areas. That's Marlin's invention with Dr. Craven.
I love the work you've done through the years with Christopher Guest. And as you say in the book, he really got you out of, well, what you call movie prison.
I was in movie jail for good reason. I'd been in a few movies that didn't do very well. They were not only box office failures, but critical failures. And you can get away with the latter, but not the former. If you don't make money after a few movies and you're one of the stars of the movie, they start to see a pattern emerge. And so I didn't work. I could go to Australia and do a movie with a little girl and a kangaroo. And I did. It's called Joey. You know, watch it somewhere. You'll see what I was up to in the 90s. So I didn't work at all in studio movies, save two jobs. I got a job on Batman Forever for a week, and I had a few weeks on a movie called Greedy. But that was it the whole decade. Otherwise, I could do television and did. But Chris put me in Best in Show. He broke me out of movie jail. He, you know, paid my bail. He's a great friend. And then I got the next one. So I went back to working in movies because of Chris Guest's trust in me and his kindness in putting me in Best in Show and all those other movies. I owe him a great deal.
We've talked before, Ed, about your environmental activism that you started long before most people were aware of you as an actor. I was wondering, as I read the book, did your friendship with Cesar Chavez have an influence on your efforts to try and make a difference in the world?
100%. He was the man I looked up to because he wanted justice for the people who worked in the fields as he used to as a young man. He and his wife, Helen, both had been workers in the field for years, so they knew what that struggle was like. And there was an environmental connection with Cesar Chavez and me, too, because the people who were getting hit hardest by the pesticides and the fungicides and the herbicides and all the misuse and overuse and abuse of those different substances were the workers in the field. They'd be there, and the planes would come over and spray while they were working below them. And so they'd come home with these horrible chemicals and dust, toxic dust on their clothing. Their families would be affected by it, too. So, you know, the environmental connection between Cesar and I was deep, and I worked with him on different environmental issues and workers' rights issues, and I had the sadness and the honor of carrying his coffin through the streets of Delano when he passed in 1993.
Well, and you have fought that fight for many, many years. Your products are great. We've talked about those. Matter of fact, just yesterday I was using my Begley's Best Stain Remover.
Oh, Thank you for that, Rich. You're so kind to use that and to bring that up. I, years ago, wanted to have non-toxic cleaning products. I used baking soda instead of Common. I used vinegar and water instead of Windex. And I saved money, and it was also clean. But I always thought there must be some way to do a formula that cleans more aggressively than vinegar and baking soda, but, you know, non-toxic. And I found some stuff with my dear friends at Lab Clean, and I work with them, and we vet the formulas together, make sure they clean well and they're non-toxic. Because you got kids, let's say you use a toxic floor cleaner, or use something on the floor to clean up a mess. You don't want that on the floor, because often kids are crawling around the floors, putting their fingers and their toes in their mouth, and your pets are crawling on the floors and putting their paws in their mouth, and, you know, these wonderful, vulnerable creatures and kids can get affected by that. So you want to have a non-toxic home. Certainly when you ask people to, as I have asked people to, seal up their home and make it more energy efficient. Great, now you've sealed it up. You've got all these toxic chemicals under the sink. Get rid of them. Try not just mine. Mine are fine, and please try them if you wish. But also, Seventh Generation makes wonderful products. There's other people out there that make wonderful products. So try one of them, and if, I hope it's mine, but any of them are good. Just get out of that toxic treadmill and try something that works well, which ours do, and also is safe.
Ed, I think it says a lot about you, and also about your good judgment when it comes to people, that you were able to become great friends with your first wife, Ingrid, after your divorce.
What a great lady she was. The fact that she would befriend me after my failed attempt at marriage, you know, there was one of the two partners that was not good at marriage the first time out, and that was me. And so I got better at the second time, but we became friendly, thank God, through her kindness, and good friends and best friends. And we were like brother and sister when she passed in 2006. So I'm so glad that I had that lady in my life. Two great kids, of course, and my son gave me some wonderful grandchildren. But she was a kind and very funny lady. We laughed together. We took a trip together. Get this, Rich. In my car, we rode up together, my current wife in the front seat with me, driving up to Oregon for my daughter's birthday. Ingrid in the back seat with my then 5-year-old daughter, Hayden. So there's Rochelle and Ingrid talking about everything you could imagine, you know, united against a common enemy, me. The line was actually heard, "Oh, he's still doing that? Imagine what it was like when he had hair and a career." So had a lot of laughs, and the fact that she continued to be my friend speaks a lot about her and also about my good fortune.
And on that trip, you write in the book about she even bunked with Rochelle.
She did. We were going to get rooms. We stopped in Shasta for the night on the way up from L.A. to Bend, Oregon for the wedding. Our daughter, Amanda, which is Ingrid's daughter and my daughter. So she's getting married, and we stopped for the night with Rochelle and my daughter, which is Hayden. So Hayden and I are told to sleep in a bed over here while the ladies stay up and they watch War of the Roses. Have you seen that movie?
Oh, yeah, yes, I have. I'm not sure if I want those two women watching that if I'm you.
I realized I did. It's about an acrimonious divorce that ends in murder. So the two of them, they're watching War of the Roses to all hours, and I'm trying to sleep with one eye open, wondering what's coming next. Fortunately, my young daughter was there to protect me in case things turned ugly.
Well, and you have clearly met your match in so many ways with Rochelle.
Yeah, she's very funny. She's a great wife, a great partner in so many ways. She cares deeply about the environment, too. She made a wonderful home for us here in our new home, which is a LEED Platinum home. And it's beautiful the way she wanted it, and it's energy efficient the way I wanted it. And I was never going to move out of my previous home, which is a very small house in Studio City. But now I have something that I didn't know that I wanted. I fought her tooth and nail, and now I think I'm happier here than she is. I got a great vegetable garden. I got 9 kilowatts of solar. I got a 10,000-gallon rainwater tank. So I got the greenest home I could ever dream of owning, and it's pretty the way she wants. It's a French Mediterranean design by a great architect named William Hefner. So it's a beautiful home.
Ed, the book is an absolutely wonderful read, funny, touching, poignant. You seem you seem grateful for all of the experiences in your life, and you offer some great advice, and it's well what every actor tries so hard to do, and it feels like you have managed to accomplish it, and that's the ability to live in the moment.
Yeah, it was a key moment for me years ago when I got a hold of this book. My friend Neil Rhodes gave me this book called This Is It. It's written by a very wise man by the name of Alan Watts, a philosopher, a great writer. And if you hear that title, you might just get what it's about and perhaps embrace it in your life, which is, this is it. This is it right now, this moment with you and I, Rich, that's happening right this second. That's really all there is. There has been a past, of course. I'm not denying that. There will be a future, and you have to plan for the future and remember the past. But most people spend too much time living in the past and worrying about the future. This is it right now, Rich. This moment right now, if you can really engage and be here with me, and I know you are, and I promise you I'm 100% there with you and listening to you and engage with you, that's beautiful too. It's not that it's just going to be better tomorrow. It's better right now for most folks. There are some people who it's not better for at all, the people enduring the quake there miles and miles away from us on the other side of the world, the people in Morocco and elsewhere. You know, those who have been fortunate have to gather ourselves and be present for our life, and then go and be of help to people who need it with earthquakes and other problems around the world. Problems right here in our own country. People who haven't eaten, people unhoused right now here in our own country. So there's lots of work to do, environmental work and other stuff. But don't try to do it frantically. Don't, as I did in the past, be on 20 different boards and do 20 different jobs poorly. Do one job well rather than 20 jobs poorly. Get yourself centered. I want to protect the environment too, but you don't protect it by running around like a crazy man and, you know, being frantic about it. Get centered, be present in the moment. This is it right now, and then go from there.
The book is To the Temple of Tranquility and Step on It. It's available October 4th from Hatchet Books and everywhere fine books are sold. Every moment we get to spend talking with you, Ed, is terrific. Thank you so much for being with us today. We wish you wonderful success with the book. We're pulling for the strike to end fairly for the actors and the writers out there, and hope you and your family continue to be happy and healthy.
Right back at you, Rich. Great interview, as always. You're wonderful to talk to.